Chapter 65. The finale of the week was Sean Courtney's bushbuck shoot. Sean and Dirk arrived at Protea Cottage with the dawn. They were dressed in rough hunting clothes, and the leather gun cases lay on the floor of the mule wagon under Sean's feet. It took nearly 15 minutes for Sean to transfer Ruth, Ada, and her girls from the cottage to the carriage, in the same way a man might drive a flock of chickens towards the door of a henhouse. He would get them all moving slowly in front of him, down the path towards the carriage, clucking and fussing. Almost there, when suddenly one of them would shriek softly and double back towards the cottage for a forgotten parasol or a work basket, and the general movement would break down again. The third time this happened, Sean felt something snap inside his head. He bellowed. A vast hush fell over the ladies, and two of them looked as though they might cry. "Now don't get worked up, my dear," Ada tried to soothe him.
"I am not getting worked up,"
Sean's voice quivered with the effort of restraint. "But if everybody is not in the carriage by the count of 10, then I might easily get that way." They were all seated by the count of 5, and he drove out to the stock pens, a very ruffled rooster. Carriages and mule wagons, carrying the entire population of the Ladyburg district, were waiting in a disorderly tangle in the field beside the stock pen. Sean trotted past in a babble of greeting and comment. One at a time, the waiting carriages wheeled into line behind him, and the long convoy wound out towards Mahuba's Kloof farm. The big shoot had begun. In the middle of the line, someone was playing a concertina, and the singing started. It spread to each carriage in turn and blended with the sound of wheels and hooves and laughter. Gradually, Sean's irritation smoothed out. Ada's girls were singing Burlant Sanoinki in the back seat. Dirk had jumped down from the carriage, and with half a dozen of the youngsters from the village ran ahead of the horses. Ruth's hand touched Sean's leg uncertainly, and as he turned and grinned at her, he saw the relief in her answering smile. "What a beautiful day, Sean."
"Sorry, I nearly spoiled it," he answered.
"Oh, nonsense." She moved closer to him, and suddenly he was happy. All the preparation was worth it. Beside him, Ruth laughed softly.
"What's the joke?"
Sean reached out and took her hand.
"No joke. I just felt like laughing," she answered. "Look how green everything is," she said it to distract him,
to make him look away so that she could study his face. The subterfuge worked.
"The land seems so young now."
His eyes, as he looked at it, took on that gentleness she knew so well. By now she knew many of his moods, and she was learning how to induce or redirect each of them. He was such a simple man, yet in that simplicity lay his strength. "He is like a mountain," she thought. "You know how it'll be with the sun on it in the early morning. You know that when the wind is in the south, there will be mist covering the crest, and in the evening the shadows will fall in certain patterns across the slopes, and the gorges will look dark and blue. Yet also you know the shape of the mountain is unchanged, that it will never change."
"I love you, my mountain," she whispered,
and anticipated the startled expression before it flashed across his face.
"Eh?"
"I love you, my man," she amended.
"Oh, I love you too."
And now he is vaguely embarrassed.
Oh, God, I could eat him!
If I were to reach over and kiss him now in front of everybody. Secretly, she savoured the idea.
"What devilment are you planning?"
he demanded gruffly. He wasn't supposed to read her so accurately. Taken off balance, she stared at him. Suddenly, the mountain had shown that it understood exactly the way she felt when she looked at it.
"Nothing," she denied in confusion. I wasn't..."
Before she realised fully what he was about, he had turned halfway in his seat towards her and lifted her bodily into his lap.
"Sure, no!"
She gasped, and then her protests were muffled. She heard the laughter of Ada's girls, the hoots of encouragement and applause from the other carriages, and she kicked and struggled, pushing with one hand against his chest and trying to keep her hat on with the other. By the time he replaced her on the seat beside him, her hair had come down behind, her hat was off, and her cheeks and ears were flaming red. She had been very thoroughly kissed.
"Nice shot, Sean. Author, author, arrest that man."
The cries and the laughter added to her confusion.
"You're terrible." Ruth used her hat as a screen behind which she tried to control her blushes. "In front of all those people, too."
"That should keep you out of mischief for a while, my lass."
And suddenly she wasn't so sure of the shape of her mountain. The cavalcade turned off along the rough track from the main road, splashed through the drift, climbed the far bank, and spread out among the trees. Servants, who had been waiting since the previous evening, ran to their masters' horses as they halted. Each vehicle disgorged a noisy blast of children and dogs, and then a more dignified trickle of adults. The women moved without hesitation towards the two huge marquees that had been erected among the trees, while the men unloaded the gun cases and began assembling their weapons. Still sitting on the front seat of the wagon, Sean opened the leather case at his feet, and while his hands automatically fitted the barrels into the breech piece of his shotgun, he allowed himself to review his preparations with a certain amount of satisfaction. He had selected this site not only for the cool grove of syringa trees which provided shade above and a soft carpet of fallen leaves below, nor for the proximity of the tinkling stream where all the animals could be watered, but also because it was situated within 15 minutes' walk of the first beat. Days before, a gang of Zulus working under Mbijani had cleared out all the undergrowth beneath the trees, had erected the marquee tents and the trestle tables, dug the cooking pits, and even built two grass-walled pit latrines discreetly out of view of the main camp. Huge log fires were burning in the cooking pits now, but by noon they would have burned down to glowing coal beds. The trestle tables about which the women had already begun working were laden with food. There was a great deal of activity going on in that direction at the moment, most of it talking. From the other wagons, men were starting to drift towards him, buckling on their cartridge belts, hefting shotguns, chatting together nonchalantly in an attempt to disguise their excitement. Under instruction from Sean, Dirk had assembled a rabble of those males who were too young to handle shotguns, but too old to stay with the women. These were making no effort to hide their excitement. Armed with sikelas, the Zulu fighting sticks, they were showing every indication of getting out of hand. Already one small boy was weeping loudly and massaging the welt he had received from a playful sikela.
"All right, shut up, all of you," Sean shouted. "Dirk will take you up to the beaters, but remember, once the hunt starts, keep in the line and listen to what you're told. If I catch anybody running about or getting ahead of the line, I'll personally wallop the tar out of him, do you understand?"
It was a long speech to shout, and Sean ended with his face flushed ferociously. This gave weight to his words and resulted in a respectful chorus of, "Yes, Mr. Courtney."
"Well, off you go, then."
Whooping, racing each other, they poured away through the trees, and a comparative peace descended on the camp.
"My God, let alone bushbuck, that lot would drive elephant, buffalo, and lion panic-stricken ahead of them," observed Dennis Peterson dryly. "How about your positions, Sean?"
Aware that he had their complete attention, Sean drew the moment out a little.
"We're going to drive the Eland's Kloof first," he announced. "Mbijani and 200 Zulus are waiting at the head of the kloof for the signal. The guns will take station at the tail of the kloof."
Sean paused.
"How about our positions?"
"Patience, patience," Sean chided them. "I know I shouldn't have to repeat the safety rules, but..."
And he immediately went on to do so.
"No rifles, shotguns only. You will shoot only in an arc of 45 degrees directly ahead of you. No passing shots to either side. Especially you, Reverend."
That gentleman, who was notoriously trigger-happy, looked suitably abashed.
"My whistle will mean the beaters are too close. All guns up and unloaded immediately."
"It's getting late, Sean."
"Well, let's get on with it, then."
"Right," Sean agreed. "I'll take centre gun."
There was a murmur of agreement. That was fair enough. The plum to the man who provided the hunt, no one could grudge that.
"On my left flank, in this order, Reverend Smiley, since the Almighty will obviously send most of the game his way, I might as well profit by it."
A burst of laughter as Smiley wavered between horror at the blasphemy and delight at his own good fortune.
"Then Ronnie Pye, Dennis Peterson, Ian Vermark, Gerald and Tony Erasmus. You two fight it out in a brotherly fashion. Nick?"
Sean read from the list in his hand. This, in strict order of seniority, was the social register of Ladyburg. A proper and exact balancing of wealth and influence, of popularity and age. Apart from placing himself in the centre of the line, Sean had not taken much part in the preparation of the list. Quite correctly, Ada had not trusted his sense of social perception.
"That takes care of the left flank," Sean looked up from the list.
He had been so engrossed in reading that he had not sensed the air of tension and expectancy which had fallen over his audience. A single horseman had crossed the drift and walked his magnificent thoroughbred into the camp. He had dismounted quietly, and servants had led his horse away. Now, carrying a shotgun, he was walking towards Sean's wagon. Sean looked up and saw him. He stared in surprise, while slowly elation mounted within him until it reached his face in a wide grin.
"Gary!
Glad you could make it," he called out spontaneously. But Gary's face remained without expression. He nodded a curt greeting.
"At least he's come," exulted Sean. "This is the first overture. Now it's up to me."
"You can take the first position on my right, Gary."
"Thank you."
Now Gary smiled, but it was a curiously cold grimace, and he turned away to talk with the nearest man. A small shiver of disappointment moved the crowd. They had expected something spectacular to happen. All of them knew of the feud between the Courtney brothers and the mystery that surrounded it. But now, with a feeling of anticlimax, they turned their attention back to Sean's reading. Sean finished and jumped down from the wagon, and immediately the crowd moved away. Sean sought Garrick, and saw him far ahead near the head of the long file of men that was strung out along the footpath that led to the Eland's Kloof.
The file moved fast as the hunters stepped out eagerly. Unless he ran, Sean knew he would not be able to pass the men ahead of him and catch up with Gary. "I'll wait until we reach the beat," he decided. "My God, what a wonderful ending to this week. I have Ruth. Now, if only I can get back my brother, and with him, Michael." From the shoulder of the gorge, Sean looked down across Eland's Kloof. A deep slot of a valley, 2 miles long and 500 yards wide at this end, but it tapered slowly upwards until it lost its identity in the high ground. The full length of it was clogged solid with dark green bush, a seemingly impenetrable mass above which a few tall trees reared up in a desperate attempt to reach the sunlight. Like the tentacles of a giant squid, creepers and vines lifted from the dark bush to overpower them and drag them down. Here on the shoulder, the air was dry and wholesome. Down there it would stink of damp earth and rotting vegetable matter. Lingering, as though suddenly reluctant to go down into the humid discomfort of the kloof, the hunters gathered on the shoulder. Shading eyes against the glare, they peered up towards the head of the gorge, where the beaters were a line of dark specks against the green spring grass.
"There go the kids," someone pointed.
Dirk was leading his band along the high ground above the kloof. Sean moved across to his twin brother.
"Well, Gary, how are things out at Tunis Kraal?"
"Not bad.
I read your book. I think it's excellent. It certainly deserved the reception it got in London. Lord Casterbrook wrote to me to say that your concluding chapter is giving the War Office much food for thought. Well done, Gary."
"Thank you."
But there was an evasive lack of warmth in Gary's reply. He made no attempt to continue the conversation.
"Michael didn't come out with you today."
"No."
"Why not, Gary?"
And Gary smiled for the first time, a cool, spiteful smile. He didn't want to.
"Oh."
The hurt showed in Sean's face for an instant. Then he turned to the men around him.
"Right, gentlemen, let's go down there."
In position now, a line of men standing quietly in the gloom and stagnant heat. Each man's neighbour visible only as an indefinite shape among the leaves and vines and fallen trees. Few things sharp, the outline of a hat brim, the glint of a random beam of sun on gunmetal, a human hand framed in a hole of dark green leaves, the silence heavy as the heat, spoiled by the nervous rustle of a branch, a hastily smothered cough, the click of a shotgun breech. Sean hooked his thumb across both hammers of his gun and pulled them back to full cock, lifted the twin muzzles to the roof of leaves above his head, and fired in rapid succession. He heard the deep booming note of the gun bouncing against the sides of the valley, echoing and fragmenting as it was thrown back upon itself. Then swiftly the silence closed in again. He stood motionless, tuning his hearings as finely as it was possible. But his reward was the thin drone of an insect and the harsh, startled cry of a bush lorry. He shrugged. 2 miles of distance and the mass of vegetation would blanket completely the cries of the beaters and the clatter of their sticks as they thrashed the bush. But they were coming now, of this he was certain. They would have heard his signal shots. He could imagine them moving down the line, 200 black men interspersed with the small white boys, chanting the rhetorical question, which was as old as the drive hunt itself.
"Yuppie! Yuppie!"
repeated over and over again, the accent on the first half of the word shrilling it.
"Yuppie! Where are you going?"
And between him and the beaters, in that wedge of tangled bush, there would be the first uneasy stirring. Dainty bodies dappled with grey, rising from the secret beds of fallen leaves. Hooves pointed and sharp, splayed and driven deep into soft leaf mould by the weight of tensed muscle. Ears pricked forward, eyes like wet black satin, shiny moist muzzles quivering and snuffling, corkscrew horns laid back, the whole poised on the edge of flight. With the taint of gun smoke in his nostrils, Sean opened the action of his shotgun, and the empty shells ejected crisply, pinging out to leave the eyes of the breech empty. He selected 2 fresh cartridges from his belt and slid them home, snapped the gun closed, and thumbed the hammers onto half-cock. Now they would be moving. The does first, ginger-brown and dappled like roe deer, slipping away down the valley with their fawns long-legged beside them. Then the bucks, the inconca, black and big and silent as shadows, crouching as they moved, horns flat against their shoulders, moving away from the faint cries and the commotion, moving their mates and their young away from danger, down towards the waiting guns.
"I heard something then,"
the Reverend Smiley's voice sounded as though he were being strangled, probably by the dog collar, which showed as a pale spot in the gloom.
"Shut up, you fool!"
Sean gambled his chance of salvation on the rebuke. But he need not have worried, for the endearment was drowned by the double blast of Smiley's shotgun, so indecently loud and totally unexpected that Sean's feet left the ground.
"Did you get him?"
Sean asked, his voice a little shaky from the fright. No reply.
"Reverend, did you get one?"
Sean demanded. He had seen nothing, and heard nothing that might, by the most generous stretch of imagination, lead anyone to suspect the presence of a bushbuck.
"My goodness, I could have sworn,"
Smiley's reply was in the kind of voice you'd expect from beyond the grave. "Oh, dear! I think I must have been mistaken." "Here we go again," thought Sean, with resignation.
"If you run out of cartridges, let me know,"
he called softly, and grinned at Smiley's injured silence. The shots would have turned the game back towards the beaters. They would be starting to mill now as they sought an avenue of escape, perhaps moving out on the flanks. As if in confirmation of Sean's thoughts, a shotgun thudded out on the left, then another, then 2 more on the right. The fun had started in earnest. In the brief silence, he heard the beaters now, their excited cries muffled, but urgent. A blur of movement ahead of him through the screen of branches, just a flick of dark grey, and he swung the gun and fired. Wallop of the butt onto his shoulder, and thud and scuffle and roll and kick in the undergrowth.
"Got him!"
exulted Sean. Still kicking, the head and shoulders of a half-grown ram emerged from under a bramble bush. It was down, mouth open, bleeding, crabbing against the earth, leaving a drag mark through the dead leaves. Boom again, the mercy stroke, and it lay still. Head speckled with tiny buckshot wounds, eyelids quivering into death, and the swift rush of blood from the nostrils. The din of gunfire all about, cries of the beaters, and the answering shouts of the gunners, the panic-stricken run and crackle in the bush ahead.
Inconca! Big one, black as a hellhound, 3 twists in the horn, eyes staring, lunging into the clearing, to halt with head up and front legs braced wide, hunted, panting, wild with terror.
Lean forward against the gun, hold the pip on his heaving chest, and fire! The bounce of the gun and the long blue gush of smoke. Knock him down with a solid charge of short-range buckshot. cleanly, quickly, without kicking. Got him! Another one, blundering straight into the gun line, blind with panic, bursting out of the undergrowth, almost on top of Shaun, Doe with Fawn at her heels. Let her go. The Doe saw him, and wheeled left to take the gap between Shaun and Garrick. As it dashed through, Shaun looked beyond and saw his brother. Garrick had left his position and closed in on Shaun. He was crouched slightly, the shotgun held in both hands, hammers fully cocked, and his eyes were fastened on Shaun. Garrick waited quietly during the initial stages of the beat. The tree trunk on which he sat was soft and rotten, covered with moss and the orange and white tongues of fungus. From the inside pocket of his jacket, he took the silver flask inlaid with carnelians. The first mouthful started his tears and numbed his tongue, but he swallowed it painfully and lowered the flask.
"He has taken from me everything I ever had of value. My leg,"
Gary looked down at the way it stuck out stiffly ahead of him, with the heel buried in the damp leaf mould. He drank again quickly, closing his eyes against the sting of brandy.
"My wife."
In the dark redness behind his eyelids, he saw her again as Shaun had left her, lying in torn clothing with bruised and swollen lips.
"My manhood. Because of what he did to her that night, Anna has never let me touch her body.
Until then there was hope, but now I am 42 years old, and I am a virgin. It is too late. My position. That swine Aitchison would never have thrown me out but for Shaun. And now he will take Michael from me." He remembered again the premonition of disaster that he had experienced when Anna reported to him how she had found Michael and Shaun together on Tunis Kraal. It had started then, each little incident building up. The day Michael had stared at the faded but bold entries in the leather-bound stock register. "Is that Uncle Shaun's handwriting?" That battered saddle Michael had found in the loft above the stables. He had polished it lovingly and re-stitched the seams, fitted new stirrup leathers, and used it for a year. Until Gary had noticed the crude initials cut into the leather of the flap. SC. That night Gary had taken the saddle and thrown it into the furnace of the hot water boiler. 8 months ago, on Michael's 21st birthday, Gary had called him into the panelled study of Tunis Kraal and reluctantly told him of Shaun's legacy to him. Michael had held the dog-eared sheet and read it through with his lips moving silently. Then at last he looked up, and his voice was shaky. "Uncle Shaun gave me a half share in Tunis Kraal, even before I was born. Why, Dad? Why did he do that?" And Gary had no answer for him. This last week had been the climax. It had taken all Anna's and Garrick's combined influence and entreaties to prevent Michael responding to the invitations Shaun had sent. Then the Zulu herd boy, whose duty was to follow Michael and come to Garrick immediately, Michael crossed the boundary of Tunis Kraal, reported that each evening Michael rode up to the high ground on the escarpment and sat there until after dark, staring in the direction of Lion Kop Ranch.
"I'm going to lose him. He is my son, even if Shaun sired him. But he is my son, and unless I prevent it, Shaun is going to take that away from me also. Unless I prevent it."
He lifted the flask to his lips once more and found with surprise that it was empty. He screwed the stopper down and returned the flask to his pocket. Around him, the gunfire and the shouting began. From the log beside him, he picked up the shotgun and loaded it. He stood up and cocked the hammers. Shaun saw him coming slowly, limping a little, crouching, making no attempt to fend off the branches that dragged across his face.
"Don't bunch up, Gary. Stay in your position. You're leaving a gap in the line."
Then he noticed Gary's expression. It seemed that the skin had been stretched tight across the cheekbones and the nose, so the rims of his nostrils were white. His jaws were chewing nervously, and there was a fine sheen of sweat across his forehead. He looked sick or deadly afraid.
"Gary, are you all right?"
Alarmed, Shaun started towards him, then stopped suddenly. Gary had lifted the shotgun.
"I'm sorry, Shaun, but I can't let you have him," he said.
The blank double eyes of the muzzles were all Shaun saw of the gun. and below them, Gary's knuckles white with pressure as he gripped the stock. One finger was hooked forward around the triggers. Sean was afraid then. He stood without moving, for his legs were heavy and numb under him.
"I've got to," Gary's voice was a croak. "I have to do it. Otherwise you'll take him. You'll destroy him also."
With fear making his legs clumsy and slow, Sean turned deliberately away from him and walked back to his station. The muscles of his back were stiff with anticipation, knotted so tightly that they ached. The beaters were close now. He could hear them shouting and thrashing the bush just ahead. He lifted the whistle to his lips and blew three shrill blasts. The shouting died away, and in the comparative silence, Sean heard a sound behind him, a sound halfway between a sob and a cry of pain. Slowly, inchingly, Sean turned his head to look back. Gary was gone. Beneath him, Sean's legs began to tremble, and a muscle in his thigh twitched spasmodically. He sank down and sat on the carpet of soft, damp leaves. When he lit a cheroot, he used both hands to steady the fluttering flame of the match.
"Dad! Dad!" Dirk came pelting out into the tiny clearing. "Dad, how many did you get?"
"Two," said Sean.
"Only two?"
And Dirk's voice went flat with disappointment and shame.
"Even Reverend Smiley beat you hollow. He got four."